Welcome to the Federal Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the International and National Security Law Practice Group and Litigation Practice Group. It was recorded on Monday, April 22, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing last week's U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Kiobel case concerning the extraterritoriality of the Alien Tort Statute. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome two experts to our teleforum conference call. We'll hear first from Professor Julian Koo, who teaches international and constitutional law subjects at Hofstra University School of Law. There, his main research interest is the intersection of international and domestic law, which is perfect for our topic today. Then we'll hear from Professor Shemin Kaitner, whose research focuses on cutting-edge issues at the intersection of international and domestic litigation. She's the author of a book, The Paradoxes of Nationalism, and over 20 articles, essays, and book chapters. Their longer bios have been provided to you on our website and also in the notice you received for today's call. So, as always, I've been brief in my introductions. We're going to get some background from the case on the case from Professor Koo, and then some opening remarks from Professor Kaitner, and then we'll hear again from Professor Koo, and then we'll get to the audience questions. So with that, Professor Koo, please go right ahead.
Okay. Thanks, Dean, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this call and giving us a chance to talk about this very interesting and important decision from the U.S. Supreme Court last week. What I'm going to do is just quickly, kind of like in law school, go through the facts of the case and the issues, and then I'll give a quick take and then turn it over to Shemin and get her thoughts. All right, so this case, Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, it involves a lawsuit brought by Nigerian nationals who filed a case under the Alien Tort Statute against Royal Dutch Petroleum, which is a Dutch, British, and Nigerian corporation. Sort of the different corporate defendants in this case were all foreign corporations. And they were brought alleging serious violations of international law, especially international humanitarian law, war crimes, and other serious human rights violations, but that occurred in Nigeria. The theory of the case was that Royal Dutch Petroleum, in cooperating and with the Nigerian government, aided and abetted or assisted in the commission of these serious international law crimes in Nigeria. This case has been sort of in litigation for a number of years for various ways, and so there's a lot of different details to it. But the procedural posture is rather complicated. The key turning point in this case came. It was appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York, and a panel of that court held, rather surprisingly at that time, that corporations are not amenable to lawsuits under the Alien Tort Statute, and the theory of that was that international law does not recognize corporations as subjects of international law, and therefore, under the Alien Tort Statute, they can't be sued under that, because that statute requires some claim of violation of international law, and arguably substantively international law govern all questions in that case. That was appealed to the Supreme Court in the previous term, not the October term 2012, but 2011, and the Supreme Court was briefed that case, heard oral arguments on the question of whether corporations could be sued under the Alien Tort Statute, but in the middle of the oral argument, decided that they really weren't interested in another issue, which was raised by some of the amicus parties in that case, and that is whether or not the Alien Tort Statute really should be interpreted to allow this sort of lawsuit at all. And the key fact that the defendants, or in those cases the amici raised, was that none of the parties to this case are U.S. nationals, nor do they have any connection to the United States territory, because the defendants in this case are Dutch, British, and Nigerian corporations, and the plaintiffs in this case are Nigerian nationals, and everything that was alleged to have happened occurred in Nigeria. And so this new issue, the court decided, instead of deciding the corporate liability issue, they decided to send it back for another round of briefing and another oral argument, which occurred last fall. on the question of whether or not the Alien Tort Statute could apply to a conduct which occurred inside the territory of another foreign sovereign. So that's sort of the unusual background. So really, in some ways, the result of this case has been at least 2 years in the waiting, at least from the Supreme Court, which is why people were pretty excited last week, at least I was, when the Supreme Court came down with their decision and with their holding, which is a little complicated, but is fairly straightforward once you go through it, which is that the presumption against extraterritoriality, the principle, the interpretive principle that the court has explored before in different cases, usually involving business law, that principle of interpretation applies to the Alien Tort Statute. And therefore, this particular case should be dismissed because this case does not have enough connection to the United States in order to rebut or overcome the presumption against extraterritoriality. This was a holding of five members of the court, the Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Scalia, and Kennedy. And in a lot of ways, this is actually a very pretty simple holding. It's the idea of the presumption against extraterritoriality is that unless Congress makes a clear statement or clear indication that they want a statute to apply to extraterritorial conduct, the presumption reads that we don't read a statute to do that unless Congress makes it clear that they want it to apply to extraterritorial conduct. And the Alien Tort Statute doesn't have such a clear statement or an indication, and therefore it shouldn't apply to conduct that occurs outside the territory of the United States. And that's pretty much it. I mean, there's some analysis here. But basically, they're relying on a 2010 decision, Morrison versus National Australia Bank, which applied that principle in the conduct of securities law. So that's, there's a lot of issues tied up in that, but in a lot of ways, it's a pretty straightforward holding. Now, really all nine justices, though, agreed that this case should be dismissed, and the four justices who joined a concurrence by Justice Breyer, who did not join in the majority opinion, also agreed to dismiss this case, but on slightly different grounds. And in that opinion, Justice Breyer held that he doesn't think the presumption against extraterritoriality necessarily applies. He thinks that, on the other hand, this case should be dismissed because the Alien Tort Statute should be limited to cases where the tort occurs in the United States, or the defendant is an American national, or if the defendant's conduct substantially or adversely affects an important American national interest. So they also would have dismissed this case because they don't believe that this case would have met that test. Again, foreign plaintiff suing a foreign defendant about conduct that occurred in a foreign jurisdiction, that wouldn't even meet the concurrences test. So in a lot of ways, there's a certain amount of agreement here. The reasoning, though, obviously is different because it doesn't seem to have the across-the-board impact that the opinion for the court by Justice Roberts had. I'll also note that there was two other concurrences, one very cryptic concurrence from Justice Kennedy, who said that there are some issues out there that are still need to be unresolved, although he wouldn't say what those were. And another concurrence from Justices Alito and Thomas, who tried to elaborate on the presumption against extraterritoriality in a very broad way that seemed to, in their view, require pretty substantial domestic conduct before the Alien Tort Statute could be invoked. So that was the result of the case. And the result of the case, I think, the end result of the case, I can say, is that cases which are so-called, involve these similar set of facts, foreign plaintiffs suing foreign defendants for actions occurring in a foreign territory, those cases are unanimously dismissed, and none of those cases will survive, I think it's pretty clear, after this decision. So what does this mean going forward? Well, I'll start to transition into let Shemin talk about it, but I think it does raise a couple issues. The opinion for the court does leave open at least the possibility that, according to Justice Roberts, the presumption against extraterritoriality in this circumstance could be overcome if the defendant's conduct or the conduct in question touches and concerns the territory of the United States. There's going to be a lot of interesting questions as to what that means. And also the old corporate liability issue that we talked about, that was originally the genesis of the Supreme Court's intervention in this case, was not resolved, and it's unclear what would happen in a future case involving corporations, whether that argument is still good or what the impact of that would be for this. So there is going to be some questions as to the most important thing, what kind of relationship with the United States is required with the territory of the United States for the Alien Tort Statute to be invoked. But the bottom line is that at least a pretty substantial set of cases is definitely knocked out under this holding, and there's been a lot of critical reaction because of that. So with that, let me turn it over to Shimon and get her comments. I've gone on long enough. Shimon?
Thank you. I'll give you a chance to come back after maybe I've drawn out a couple of the points that you made, Julian. So, you know, the interesting thing about this statute, which as everyone knows by now, was part of the first Judiciary Act. So it dates back to 1789, and it provides federal jurisdiction when an alien sues for a tort committed in violation of the law of nations. So we know by the terms of the statute that we've got a foreign plaintiff. Now, as it turns out, a lot of the plaintiffs in these cases are in the United States. That's why they bring their suits here. They may be here, some of them as permanent residents. Many of them have been granted asylum because of the very persecution they've faced in the foreign countries relating to the acts that give rise to the suit that they eventually bring. But you're going to have some foreign element by virtue of the fact that only aliens have standing to sue. So then the second question, as Julian said, is, well, then how do we, you know, figure out the reach of this jurisdiction? In the 2004 Sosa case, the Supreme Court set some limits. They said, well, you can't just sue for any violation of the law of nations. It has to be a very specific, universally accepted violation. But in terms of territorial reach, even though the United States in that case, in the Sosa case, had argued for limiting the extraterritorial reach of the statute, the Sosa case really didn't get into that. So that's where this, you know, second round of Kiobel briefing really addressed this issue head on. And so we know we've got a foreign plaintiff. So the question becomes, well, are we just giving standing to sue to foreign plaintiffs for injuries that arise in the United States, which is essentially the position that Justices Alito and Thomas would have taken or took in their concurrence? Or is there something, some broader category of potential claims that can still be brought under this statute? And that's what Julian mentioned, that there the majority opinion and the concurrence would have designated that remaining category of claims with slightly different language. And of course, it's the majority opinion's language that prevails. I'm not so sure, though, and this is a genuine question mark, that I would agree with Julian that no so-called foreign cubed cases can go forward. That is where we have a foreign defendant engaging in conduct overseas. Now, it's absolutely true, as Julian says, that the Roberts opinion, the controlling opinion, says that not only must the claims, quote, touch and concern the territory of the United States, but they must do so with sufficient force to displace this presumption against extraterritorial application. So you obviously need a very compelling argument to extend jurisdiction to any sort of foreign defendant for foreign conduct. However, this cryptic, and I certainly agree with Julian's characterization of the concurrence by Justice Kennedy, who in oral argument had been very concerned about what we might call the Falardiga kind of cases. So many of you may recall this 1980 case that sort of started the ball rolling in all of this was against a Paraguayan inspector general of police who overstayed his tourist visa in the U.S., was living in the Bronx, and was served with a civil suit for torture and extrajudicial killing that he committed in Paraguay. Now, there's absolutely nothing, and I would agree with Julian here, in the Roberts opinion, in the controlling opinion, to suggest that the majority was worried about preserving these kinds of cases. But it does seem to me that Justice Kennedy was worried about these cases, not only in his questioning and oral argument, but also in this line in his concurrence where he says, you know, there may be some case out there that's not captured by the Torture Victim Protection Act, which is a much more recent statute that explicitly gives a cause of action for torture or extrajudicial killing committed under color of foreign law. So we know we've got a foreign defendant there, although only for torture and extrajudicial killing and not against corporations. So again, much more limited. And that's also not captured, he said, that falls outside the, quote, reasoning and holding of the majority's opinion. So, you know, the things that might come to mind for me are, for example, you know, we have a criminal prohibition in the United States Code against genocide, including genocide committed, you know, by foreigners in foreign countries. You know, well, what if someone who had committed genocide, you know, overstayed their tourist visa in the United States? Would the U.S.'s, you know, interest in providing a safe harbor, to use Justice Breyer's language, as Julian mentioned, which obviously isn't the controlling language, but, you know, would that touch and concern the territory of the United States under the Roberts opinion? Or is it, you know, precisely because the Roberts opinion did not use that safe harbor language, are those indeed outside the scope of the opinion? And if we didn't have Justice Kennedy's concurrence, I would tend to, you know, be more confident in agreeing with Julian that we're knocking out those cases too. But I think because we've got some tension in the concurring opinions, and the Alito-Thomas opinion is not the majority opinion, which says we would only limit this to U.S. conduct, there is wiggle room there. And something to note for those of you who haven't read the opinion, it's actually remarkably short. So I think, I don't know, I don't want to speak for you, Julian, but we waited so long for this opinion that some of us were fearing the sort of, you know, 200 pages of multiple concurrences. And in fact, you know, the whole thing, so the majority opinion plus three concurrences runs to about 35, 36 pages. So it's very narrow. It really doesn't spill a lot of ink, but perhaps for that reason, we'll be subject to, you know, further litigation in the lower courts as to exactly the parameters of the restrictions that have now been placed.
Okay. Shimon, let me, are you done?
No, please, go ahead.
I think it's sometimes my own take is that we may be overreading the concurrences a little bit. Because, you know, if you take a step back and realize the big picture here, which I've tried to emphasize in some of my other writings on this, you know, nine justices agree that this case, which is, you know, a pretty serious type of and not a unusual type of alien tort statute case brought by Nigerian plaintiffs alleging, you know, pretty awful things, effectively atrocities by the Nigerian government and complicity in atrocities by the Nigerian government and a corporation, you know, being complicit with it, that this is a pretty, you know, it's a pretty awful claim alleging pretty serious violations of international law. And the all nine members of the court agree this is dismissed, right? So, and to me, that was one of the big takeaways of the case, because it wasn't that the five so-called conservative judges agreed that this case should be dismissed because there's a presumption against extraterritoriality that applies, which I think, you know, makes a lot of sense. But even the concurrence, the four so-called liberal justices also would have dismissed this case, and it did in fact vote to dismiss this case, on the grounds that this does not sufficiently, reach the impact U.S. interests. So in other words, the idea here is that we have, you know, a foreign corporation engaged in, you know, allegedly engaged in really serious atrocities in a foreign country. And, you know, under the, you know, the classic conception here, in a pretty serious crime, if we read the Alien Tort Statute broadly, there have been quite a few of these cases brought. Even the more sort of sympathetic judges would have dismissed this particular fact pattern. So I think what we're left with then are, so in other words, a lot of the typical Alien Tort Statute cases against corporations anyways, all of them involve, you know, 99% of the conduct occurs in a foreign jurisdiction, like in Nigeria. And the defendant might be a foreign corporation, it might be a U.S. corporation, but generally speaking, most of the alleged, you know, complicity even occurs in the territory of a place in Nigeria or some other foreign country. And so if you just look at the facts of this case and the fact that all nine justices voted to dismiss the facts of this case, suggests to me that future cases are going to be very hard to bring which have a similar fact pattern, no matter how awful the allegations of what the corporation might have done. at least all nine members of the court agree that, you know, even the worst crime the corporation was alleged to have been complicit in, or even arguably to have done, if they didn't do that in the United States, then it's beyond the reach of the Alien Tort Statute. At least it seems like there's a broad agreement among all nine justices, and that really surprised me. I frankly thought that there would be a dissent, or maybe the concurrence would have been a little bit more aggressive in trying to carve out something else. And in fact, the concurrence seemed to, at best, suggest that what they would preserve would be what Shimon called the Filardiga-type cases, which involve someone who's essentially living in the United States, but who committed alleged atrocities abroad, but who sort of is escaping the reach of international law or U.S. law by getting safe harbor here in the United States. know, that was what he emphasized in the prior concurrence, but that leaves out still a lot of cases involving pretty horrible conduct, supposedly, or allegedly, in occurring in foreign jurisdictions. So in that sense, I think the big, for me, the big takeaway here is that the really expansive claims under the Alien Tort Statute and the theory that it really can reach any really serious international law violation because of the seriousness of the international law violation, that expansive vision of the Alien Tort Statute, that's what's gone because all nine justices agreed to cut back. Now, I think there is going to be some litigation over what's left, and it might be there might be enough support for a small set of cases in the Kennedy concurrence, but I'm not sure. And let me just push back one on the Kennedy concurrence. You know, when I first read the concurrence, I actually thought he didn't join the majority opinion, but he did in fact join the majority opinion. So he signed on to the Roberts opinion. He clearly thinks it leaves open some questions, but he did agree that with the pretty broad sweep of that opinion, which I agree with you is quite short, but does contain some pretty broad language. Apply the presumption against extraterritoriality to the Alien Tort Statute. All five judges agree with that. And, you know, we therefore, if we want to bring a case under the Alien Tort Statute, you're going to have to show me some conduct which, as the language of the Supreme Court, or the Roberts opinion, some conduct that touches and concerns the territory of the United States, and I think in a more than simply having a presence here. That much I think is clear, and that you know I think that's going to be litigated, but I'm not sure that's a very promising avenue of litigation for future plaintiffs, which are going to have a much tougher time I think down the road. So that's my big take on the case with respect to that. I don't know if you had, but I'll let you you know comment on that, and I think we have a little time to comment on that if you want to respond to that, Shimon.
Yeah. So Julia, I am curious. One thing that you mentioned was that a lot of these cases have, I agree, been brought for foreign conduct, but by either U.S. or foreign corporations. So one thing I think you and I probably haven't discussed very much yet is the implications of these, or are the implications of this decision for U.S. companies. So one question would be, you know, precisely because Justice Kennedy did join the majority opinion, and in fact it's his vote that made it the majority opinion, that's why I tend to use the concurrence as more of an interpretive tool, perhaps, because if it were, you know, if it weren't one of the authors of the majority opinion or co-signers, as you say, writing this concurrence, then one might sort of ignore it, but one has to sort of assume that he was somehow articulating his reasons for agreeing to the majority opinion because he had in mind certain not very well articulated or perhaps not at all articulated caveats. So what about U.S. defendants, I mean, corporations or individuals? Because, you know, Roberts talks about, you know, the claims touching and concerning the territory of the United States. So clearly, if the conduct occurs on U.S. soil, then I think, you know, all nine justices would agree that the claims could go forward, although at that point, you probably wouldn't need the ATS. You'd have some
right.
sort of other claim under some sort of other statute. But what about the conduct of U.S. companies, or for that matter, U.S. individuals? You know, to the extent that Justice Roberts was clear to say in his opinion, you know, what would not suffice for one of these claims to go forward is mere corporate presence in the U.S., right? And so I think there is this pushback against these ideas of general jurisdiction against corporations. You know, by virtue of doing business in the United States, you open yourself up to the jurisdiction of U.S. courts for a variety of unrelated claims. But how about corporations that are actually domiciled here, that actually have U.S. nationality? I mean, that was one of Justice Breyer's explicit categories of claims that he thought should go forward. What do you think about the majority's approach to that? And I will just say that I think that I understand that you agree with the presumption against extraterritoriality applying here. One thing to maybe flag for listeners is, you know, it is a strange doctrine or a strange interpretive canon to appeal to here, because as the majority acknowledges, this isn't a statute that tells you what you can and can't do. It just says what kind of claims can be brought. That is, it's strictly jurisdictional. And so, you know, to apply a presumption against extraterritorial application to a statute that on its terms is purely jurisdictional, it's a strange, conceptually strange thing to do. And so the implications that flow from that, I think, are still a little bit, you know, are not maybe quite as clear cut as some perhaps, or maybe as you suggested in your opening remarks.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, I agree with you that it is unusual. I think that the classic case, like of the presumption against extraterritoriality, is some sort of federal statute that regulates conduct. It has very general, like the anti-discrimination law or the securities laws say, you know, don't commit fraud, or you can't commit fraud, or you can't discriminate on the basis of race. And the courts have, in recent years anyways, applied this presumption against extraterritoriality to say, okay, well, you know, Congress, when they enacted that, clearly did not mean to apply that to foreign jurisdictions or foreign conduct, even if they involve U.S. nationals. But the theory behind that was that applying it, you know, Congress, we should be required to state clearly they meant to apply to regulate foreign conduct. And this is different in a sense, because all Congress has done is given the courts jurisdiction and then allowed them to, at least supposedly, allow them to interpret international law to create causes of action. Having said that, my own take on that would be, I agree that it's unusual. I'm not sure it's necessarily unreasonable to apply that presumption here, because I'm not saying you're saying that, but it, you know, I think it's not necessarily illogical to do so, because I think what the court seems to be concerned with the presumption against extraterritoriality is not foreign policy consequences of essentially allowing these sorts of litigation to continue to go forward. And they cite several times, you know, foreign governments have protested these litigations. And so one of the rationales for the presumption against extraterritoriality is to limit conflicts with foreign governments, or at least to make Congress make a decision as to whether to create such a conflict with a foreign government. So that did seem to be at least their theory of why they would apply the presumption here. And I don't think that seemed to me pretty reasonable. But let me just go back to one thing. In terms of reading the Roberts opinion, you said, well, you know, how would it apply to U.S. nationals? Well, this goes to the larger point. The presumption against extraterritoriality, in prior cases, it's not really concerned with nationality. It's concerned with conduct. Where did the conduct occur? And the first recent case the Supreme Court applied it was a case called EEOC versus Arab American, and that actually involved two U.S. nationals, a U.S. national who claimed discrimination by another U.S. national, but that the conduct occurred in Saudi Arabia or outside the United States. So the origins of this, and even in the Morrison case, that was a little different, but the conduct seemed to be the focus, and if the conduct is overseas, then even if the nationality of the plaintiff and defendant are, you know, American, that doesn't overcome the presumption against extraterritoriality in that context. And since Roberts, I mean, if you read the Roberts opinion, I was struck by it's just Morrison. They say, oh, this is just Morrison, which is along the same line of cases, which is it's about conduct. And even in the last paragraph, which is really the only operative language of the whole case, he says, on these facts, all the relevant conduct took place outside the United States. And he didn't use phrase, you know, any wiggle room. Well, you know, and there's no U.S. nationals involved here either. He kept the focus throughout the opinion on the conduct. Where did the conduct occur? And that fit in with his concern about, well, interfering with, you know, foreign governments' control of their own territory. So I think the focus on conduct means that the nationality of the defendant may not be particularly important, at least if we keep with the idea that the Morrison approach applies. It's really where the conduct occurred. So my last thought on this then, and then we can, I'll let you respond and we'll go to some questions, is that there could be conduct, whether they're U.S. national or a foreign corporation, if some of the conduct occurred in the United States. I think I wonder if that's what they're thinking of. If some of the collaboration or complicity or whatever acts that might... if it was directed from the United States, or if it was planned in the United States, or if decision makers in the United States had clear knowledge of it and it did nothing about it, or they should have known about it and ignored it, maybe that's the situation. I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here, but it strikes me it's not about conduct. It's not about the nationality, but it's about where the conduct occurs. And in this situation, we could imagine there could be situations where conduct occurs, at least in the United States, and that might be the situation where under this last paragraph, that might overcome the presumption against extraterritorial application, where most of the conduct occurs overseas, but some of the key conduct occurs here in the territory of the United States. So that's my sort of first take on that. And I'll, you know, if you have any thoughts on that, we should, you know, I'd be curious to hear it.
Thanks, yeah, no, I'm happy to open to questions, and I guess that could be one plausible reading, given that the Alito-Thomas concurrence obviously did not attract more than their, you know, those two signatures, and that concurrence, as you know, would have required pretty much all of the conduct, or at least the most egregious conduct, to happen in the United States. So again, you know, reading the opinion that did attract five signatures against the ones that didn't may also give us some sense on the other end of what even the majority didn't fully accept as the limiting principle. But
okay,
yeah, I'm happy to turn over to questions as well.
So yeah, so why don't we open up to questions, Dean? Or?
Very good. Thank you, professors. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts or both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on 1 second. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. They're happy to take your questions. Our phone lines are open with our first caller ringing in here, so let's go to our first question.
Thank you. Clearly, after the Sosa decision, human rights groups showed that they were persistent in going forward with these kind of cases, and even though they lost unanimously, they tried to turn that into a victory, and it sounds as though the same thing is happening here. In many of the ATS cases that I have seen, the plaintiffs have also tried to state causes of action under state law, even though they're in federal court. And so they have gotten a number of federal courts to allow these state law claims to go forward. It would seem to me that that would be, for the future, a very easy way to get around limitations on ATS causes of action. And I'm wondering if either of you see that as the way that disgruntled human rights lawyers will be turning in the future.
Let me try that first, and then if you want to jump in. I actually think that's right. I think, in fact, Shimon and I were both, at a symposium last year, which actually predicted to some degree that we're going to see a shift to state law claims, at least for me, and I think Shimon's probably thought about this more than I have. But to me, this kind of makes sense, and actually I'm less hostile to this type of claim. But on the other hand, they're going to have to go through a choice of law analysis, and in many cases they'll have to apply foreign law depending on where they bring the lawsuit. And so that's to some degree a little less attractive for that reason. They might have a difficulty. They may sue in California, but end up, in this case, for instance, saying, or sue in New York, but you know, everything happened in Nigeria, Nigerian law should apply. And that might be less attractive for plaintiffs depending on the case. And then the other issue that's looming out there is there have been previous decisions which allow, where courts have held that certain kinds of state interpretations or actions that involve foreign affairs could be preempted either dormantly or explicitly by federal action. So that's also a possible defense that we've seen in some of these state law claims. But I agree with you that, you know, if the broad reading or even the narrow reading of this case holds, you know, we'll see, perhaps in addition to or maybe instead of the Alien Tort Statute claims, we'll see claims under state law. Shimon, did you have any?
Yeah, so I would definitely direct readers to that symposium. It's in the UC Irvine Law Review, and I think many of those contributions are available online, if I'm not mistaken. So you're absolutely right that a lot of thought has been given to this. I'm not so sure by disgruntled human rights lawyers so much as people who are legitimately figuring out for their clients whether there's obtainable redress in the forums of the country in which they now live. But I do think that part of the reason that lawyers use the ATS rather than state law, historically anyway, was because, even choice of law aside, you know, what international law characterizes as, you know, torture or genocide or a crime against humanity, state law is going to translate into much more sort of garden variety tort terms, right? So as you well know, these will be claims for battery, for wrongful killing, and although the underlying conduct, of course, is the same. The characterization, I think it was felt in state court, didn't really live up to the magnitude of what we were talking about. So certainly that is lost by going with state law claims. The other thing that's lost is, I think, what was the intention of the Alien Tort Statute originally? Because remember, as I said, and as you well know, this was part of the first Judiciary Act. So the whole point of the ATS was to say, you know, there are certain claims that by their nature belong in federal court rather than state court. And in particular, when these are transnational claims, even though, of course, state courts also deal with transnational claims of various sorts, you know, these ones are sort of so connected to the national interest of the United States that our federal judiciary should be handling them. And so it really is paradoxical in a way that if in an attempt to sort of curb perceived overreaching by the federal courts, what we're doing is essentially directing people to encourage, again, quote-unquote, overreaching by the state courts, it would perhaps be an unintended consequence of this decision.
I just want to say one thing, Shimon, though. I mean, given that many of the plaintiffs are foreign nationals, wouldn't a lot of these cases end up in federal court anyways? Or,
well, and that's a fair question. So you'd have the state law claims in a federal court. But again, there's a question of...
I think maybe your point is that maybe the federal law, I mean, there might be the argument that federal law should, not just federal courts, but federal law, you know, or federal courts interpreting international law is really the goal here, and that's being subverted, which I suppose that's possible here. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, I mean, I think that the, you know, I think we'll see the state law, my prediction is we'll see state law claims brought, you know, in federal court, and I do think that the choice of law issue is out there. But I do wonder whether, I think a lot of the excitement about the Alien Tort Statute was about its invocation of international law and the broad principles that it seemed to open. My own view on it, by the way, just to say, is that I often thought of it as, and I tended to agree with the history of it, that was really about allowing lawsuits against U.S. nationals. So I'm not against U.S. nationals for conduct that occurred here. That seems to me at least a pretty good guess as to what they were thinking of at the time, although there's a lot of debate over this. In other words, foreign ambassadors or foreign nationals who were seriously wronged in the United States, giving them a cause of action, that seems to be a reasonable interpretation as to what the purpose of the ATS might be. So I'm not sure we're necessarily going to subvert that purpose by this result here, even though those types of cases are quite rare.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open at this point. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if there are other questions, let me make a programming announcement here. We have four more Teleforum conference calls scheduled for the remainder of the week, one each day for the remainder of the week. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Tuesday, we'll be talking about corporate public disclosure of political activity. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. And Wednesday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about the rule of law after Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. Thursday at noon, we'll be talking about the perceived war on women. And then Friday at 1 p.m., we'll be discussing Missouri versus McNeely, the recent Supreme Court case on warrantless blood tests to determine alcohol levels. And with that, let's go to our next caller question.
Hi, and thank you for a very interesting presentation. It's way out of my area of expertise, but I wonder if you would comment on two aspects of it for those of us that are not specialists or involved in that kind of litigation. That is, one, what are the politics or the ideology that is behind the controversy on these cases? And secondly, whose financial ox gets gored? And what kinds of entities are likely to gain or suffer in the future, depending on the direction that law develops? Thank you.
I went first last time. Did you want to go?
Sure, I can jump in. So those are very interesting questions, and what's particularly interesting about them, I think, is that as Julian and I have mentioned, this sort of modern wave of ATS litigation really did begin during the Carter administration at the end of the 1970s, early 1980s, with suits against individual human rights violators who, for one reason or another, sought refuge in or came to the United States. And my impression, at least, is that nobody had a big beef with those cases. They were generally brought by, nonprofit organizations, the individuals involved. Many of them didn't have assets in the United States anyway, so the judgments were largely symbolic. And in many ways, that's exactly what the plaintiffs were seeking. They weren't trying to make money. They were trying to have somebody with legal authority say that what happened to them violated international law. However, in the mid-1990s, people realized that individual human beings may well act on their own or on behalf of a government to inflict harm on other humans, but they may also be acting on behalf of or with the assistance of corporations. And so then we started to see suits brought against corporations for either participating directly or aiding and abetting human rights abuses. And that's where I think both the politics and the money started coming into play. The money because we then had suits that were heavily defended by defense firms, with their billable hour schemes, where some of the previous individual cases, were default judgments. We also had some more traditional plaintiffs firms getting into the action because you needed, more in-depth discovery, things that you really needed a significant budget to be able to do. Now, some of them certainly did this on a pro bono basis, but others may have had their typical contingency fee arrangements. And so from the lawyer's perspective, this became sort of an enterprise involving, cash flows, and also potentially, of course, from a recovery perspective. So to date, if I'm not mistaken, there haven't actually been any jury verdicts against corporations in these cases, but there have been a couple of settlements. And so that's both enabled some reconstruction of the villages and things that have been decimated by these kinds of activities, but of course they also mean that understandably, corporate counsel are paying a lot more attention to them because they can affect a company's bottom line. And I think that's when some of the politics came into play, where you got a very active role, for example, and I don't know if politics or ideology is the appropriate word here, but, played by, understandably, the Chamber of Commerce, really defending corporate interests in these cases. And you also have, as we saw in this opinion, although Julian pointed out, we did have a 9-0 agreement on the result in this particular case. You did have sort of the typical quote-unquote liberal conservative split on the reasoning where much sharper limits were thought to be imposed or were imposed by the conservative justices with the support of Justice Kennedy, whereas the quote-unquote liberal justices would have allowed sort of broader categories of cases to go forward.
Yeah, let me just add that there was, for the first time we saw, and everything I agree with everything Shimon said, I'll say that the one we saw the a bit of an ideological divide, you can call that, open up in the second Bush administration, which began to, for the first time, filing briefs supporting defendants in alien tort statute cases and taking positions that were somewhat critical of the federal court's interpretation of the Alien Tort Statute. And that changed again when we came back to the Obama administration, although that administration, the briefs they filed were not wholly supportive of the plaintiffs. For instance, in this Kiobel case itself, in the second round of briefing, the friend of the court brief filed by the Solicitor General actually did support the defendants, although on different grounds. So, I do think that there's a definitely discernible ideological shift. In fact, the first critical take on the Alien Tort Statute was by none other than Judge Robert Bork. I mean, the first judicial critical take was Judge Robert Bork in an early case called Taylor Wren, and he had raised some serious questions about the use of the Alien Tort Statute, recognizing causes of action in that case. And so there has been a conservative discomfort with the Alien Tort Statute, even though Shimon's right that there really haven't been any, massive judgments or any judgments, actually. There have been settlements. But I think that there's been some concern about its abuse or its potential abuse. And I would say this, this particular case, I do think, though, is not so much about hostility to the Alien Tort Statute or criticism of it. It's certainly that's in part. But I think the justices have been, the presumption against extraterritoriality has been something that has been developed somewhat more aggressively in decisions in the last 20 years. And that's something that you know, was not something that would have been raised against the Alien Tort Statute maybe 30 years ago. It's something that conservatives in the court have embraced, and so we see the result of that here. I do think that for the most part they have been consistent in this presumption, and they have applied it, you know, across the board, I suppose, but it has typically gored, so to speak, the offices of statutes that, you know, their ideological, you know, opponents might typically favor. So there's definitely a certain ideological component to it. I would say that, you know, it's unclear, it's never been clear how much money is in stake in all these cases, because it's always been, well, there's a potential, but we, you know, because there are all these issues that have been fought out over the years, there have been relatively few settlements and no judgments yet.
I might make one other comment briefly on the sort of ideological ironies in this case, right? So it's been pointed out in some previous discussions of the extraterritoriality issue that, in a way, well, in fact, the amicus briefs that Julian mentioned in the first round of briefing and argument were actually arguing that international law itself precludes the extraterritorial application, or at least seriously limits the extraterritorial application of this statute, if we want to speak in those terms. I mentioned earlier why I think that's a little bit incongruous. But in other words, you know, saying that those who were seeking to vindicate international law values were in fact contradicting those values by some sort of U.S. judicial imperialism. There's a similar sort of irony, I think, in terms of the process in this case. So both the Second Circuit's opinion, which as Julian mentioned is on this question of corporate liability, and the Supreme Court's ultimate opinion, which was on the question of extraterritoriality, those weren't questions raised by the parties in those cases. So the Second Circuit's opinion on corporate liability had been briefed and argued in another Second Circuit case, and as it turns out, to the same panel, but not in the Kiobel case. And the court basically reached out and said, you know, we're going to dismiss this because we don't think there's subject matter jurisdiction, since we don't think corporations can violate international law to begin with. And then when the Supreme Court granted cert on that question, as we all then observed, it basically shifted course and said, you know, we're less interested in that question, which is the one that actually had a circuit split, and we're more interested in this question of extraterritorial application. So interestingly, a statute that has been criticized historically from the right, so to speak, for empowering judges to sort of create their own ideas about international law and enforce them sort of too broadly, has been curtailed by what I would characterize, and I'm certainly happy for Julian to push back on this, but as, you know, similar kind of judicial overreaching in the absence of guidance by Congress, we're going to say, actually, you know, it doesn't apply this way, and we're going to make those findings, you know, granted in a context, at least at the Supreme Court level, in which it was fully briefed by the parties, but in which the judges had really raised the issues themselves.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that completely. I do agree with your point that they're so crazy. I mean, the procedural posture, I would hate to, I hate explaining this to my students. What's going on here? How do they decide this case when it wasn't even, with this issue when it wasn't really briefed, at least not in the lower courts? I do think part of that, though, is this weird, this is a jurisdictional statute-only situation. So under the Alien Tort Statute, almost everything appears to be a jurisdictional issue. Like, it's really confusing, but like, because a statute only grants jurisdiction, doesn't create a cause of action, but allows courts to recognize causes of action, almost all the challenges are styled as some sort of jurisdictional challenge. And when it's a jurisdictional challenge, the courts feel like, ah, well, we can pick among all the different jurisdictional challenges, and we can just, you know, we can raise them ourselves. You know, they feel much more comfortable about it. Even the presumption against extraterritoriality, which isn't typically thought of necessarily as a jurisdictional challenge, could very well be a jurisdictional challenge in the context of a statute which is only jurisdictional. And that's, I think, at least part of the confusion. But I thought we were going to go another direction with the ideological irony, which I think I've gotten some pushback in my own comments on the web about this, which is that, you know, like, why are conservatives so jumpy about a statute that regulates extraterritorial conduct when they've in the past supported actions by the U.S. government either to regulate extraterritorial conduct or, say, to go after terrorists for extraterritorial conduct, which may or may not have a deep connection to the U.S. or et cetera. And I think that there's something to that, although I think my own view is that there is something different about courts interpreting a statute which has very fuzzy sort of and uncertain origins expansively. And I do like the clear statement rule, at least on policy grounds, because it really does force Congress to say, we are going to go after, we're going to criminalize this extraterritorial conduct. We're going to go after, drug lords. Or we're going to go after terrorists, and we're going to have to say, make them say that in the statute. I think from a policy matter, I think that's a conservative-friendly ideological holding that most conservatives can sort of rally around, and that explains, I think, the court, some of the justices here see this really as a separation of powers battle, and they're trying to rein in the lower federal courts and try to drag Congress back into this area to make them try to make some decision as to what. Whether they really want these sorts of lawsuits to continue or to go forward, and force them to do something or on these sorts of cases if they want, and if they don't, then to stop these cases from happening. And I think the separation of powers critique is probably the biggest ideological issue that is driving the conservative justices here.
Once again, if you have a question, our phone lines are open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a question. I think this is related to one that's already been asked, but I didn't hear from Julian Koo on this. And that's the I sort of alluded to the idea that there's a lot of debate in the country now that the court is either or is not pro-business. And people point to the five quote-unquote conservatives as pro-business in particular. This decision has a 5-4 aspect, as Professor Keitner noted, but also has a 9-0 aspect. How does that break down in terms of supporting or rejecting the argument that the court is or is not pro-business?
Maybe I'll start, or do you want to go, Shimon?
Yeah, I was asking you, Professor.
Okay, all right. So I don't think of this as, like I was just saying, I'm not sure I see this as driven by pro-business sentiments, although I will say that, it is interesting that, no members of the court were troubled by dismissing this case. And I think there's, to some extent, there's a pro-business element in that they really didn't feel that that the business relationship, the business contacts that Royal Dutch has in the United States, it would be enough to satisfy. No one did, right? No one thought that merely doing business and would satisfy their standards for what the ATS should allow them to do. So I suppose you could describe that as pro-business. But like I said, I don't think this case came to them in the business context, and they were really thinking about the separation of powers issue, about Congress versus the courts that I just mentioned. I will say, though, the original reason they heard the case and the original issue, the question of corporate liability, is much more of a business-like question, right? It's like the court was being asked to hold that under the Alien Tort Statute, international law claims against corporations cannot be recognized because international law does not recognize corporations as subjects, or some variation on that argument. And that would have been portrayed as a massively pro-business holding if it had come out that way. Even in that case, though, the argument is largely, I think, a separation of powers argument, at least in my view, which is about, is this really something the courts can reach out and decide that, international law can recognize corporate liability, or that federal law is intended to reach this activity? Is that something that really is a judicial question, or something, again, that should be left for Congress to decide? And I think the frustration that many folks who call themselves conservatives who would with the Alien Tort Statute is that the statute really doesn't say anything, and it frustrates them that the courts have interpreted it in ways that seem pretty creative and accrue to themselves at least potentially a lot of lawmaking power. That's what I think troubled judicial conservatives over the years with the Alien Tort Statute, and that's why I think many of them will welcome this decision, even though it's not the traditional, it's a somewhat new way to sort of restrict the statute.
I was just going to say, Professor Kiner, we've got a couple more caller questions, but if you want to weigh in on this point, go right ahead.
Let's let the callers in since they've listened to us a lot already.
Okay, we do have a hard stop today on the hour, so we'll try and get to both these questions if we can.
I'd just like to know whether, given the roadblocks now to such international lawsuits in the United States, are there other nations with ATS-like provisions or other kinds of forum where they're likely to migrate?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have an answer to that. Shimon, do you have any?
No, there actually are. There's an amicus brief that was filed in the second round on Kiobel on behalf of, I think, a French Supreme Court judge and a number of prominent jurists. He basically said, you know, there's not a statute that looks like our 1789 ATS, but there certainly are statutes that permit civil suits for violations of the law of nations in various guises. And in fact, maybe what was most unusual about the U.S. statute was something that didn't have anything to do with the ATS at all, which is just that we have historically had the sort of broader sense of general jurisdiction, particularly when it comes to business activities. And that may be what the court is reining in, although, as Julian said, not reining in nearly as much as it could have by just saying that corporations are exempt from this statute altogether. So I think what you will see, for example, in this case are, you know, suits brought in the United Kingdom, in the Netherlands, where some of these defendants were incorporated. I think you will see more U.S. suits against U.S. corporations. And so maybe what we'll see is more suits in, if not the place where the conduct occurred, because often those judicial systems are not well equipped to deal with this, at least if they're in, you know, sort of conflict situations. But in the defendant's sort of quote-unquote home jurisdictions, or I think as Justice Ginsburg said in a recent opinion on jurisdiction, you know, where the corporation is essentially at home.
Looks like we have one final question. Let's go to our final caller.
One of the troubling developments, I think, in recent times in the Supreme Court, particularly in statutory cases, is the unwillingness of dissenters to accept a majority opinion. And let's assume for the sake of argument that the next retiree is Justice Kennedy and that he retires while there is a president in the White House. Do you see a willingness among the well, I would call it dissenters, the four concurring judges in this case, to accept the broad limitations on overseas application of the ATS that the majority espoused, or do you see a continuing trend of simply saying, okay, now that we are in the majority, we will reinterpret the statute our way?
Yeah, I'll try that first. I'm not sure. I take your point to be, suppose Justice Kennedy retires and we bring in a new judge who is more sympathetic to the Breyer concurrence. Would they then just hear the case again and just say, okay, actually, we want to go with the Breyer concurrence? You know, I actually don't know. I think that's certainly possible, but and the nature of this case is the nature of the I guess I doubt it in this particular instance. I don't think that this is enough of an issue for them to go out on a jurisprudential mat and say, oh, you know, we're just going to reverse randomly what we just decided a few years ago. Because I don't think this really is one of those core decisions that would be the justices feel so strongly about.
You wouldn't really need to reverse it. You would just simply say, well, we interpret it the way that liberals are trying to interpret it right now, which is that it really only applies to foreign corporations. And the moment you have a United States corporation that's headquartered in New York City, well, then, of course, the decision was never really intended to apply, despite the pretty clear Justice Roberts.
Yeah, I take your point to that. And I do think that, and I think that's, well, we can see that, but I think we've seen yeah, both sides of the spectrum do that a little bit. I do think that's certainly something that we can see happening, and I think that an outright reversal seems unlikely. But I think, you know, a paring back. I mean, the way I read the Breyer concurrence is this is an intended to be a majority opinion, which didn't quite get the fifth vote, and so he's gonna, you know, I think, you know, if I were him, I would, you know, probably be open to trying to bring as much of that in. And but it must be said though that the Roberts concurrence was short, as Shimon said, and extremely, it's not as clear as it could be, and that's why Justice Alito wrote his concurrence, I assume. But unfortunately for Justice Alito, that just makes it clear that the Roberts opinion doesn't appear to resolve quite as much as they think it does. And so it does seem to open the door, at least, to battling it. I wonder if that was, I hope that maybe not their intention, but it seems like that's a signal. Oh, well, you know, this Roberts opinion is thin enough that we, you know, maybe we can sort of sneak something in, because he could have written it in a certainly more comprehensive way than he did. And otherwise, I don't think he would have drawn the concurrence that he got from Justice Alito.
Well,
very
quick
point. Oh, yeah.
Go ahead if you want to make a quick comment.
We're just at the very end of the hour. I mean, some people felt that this was actually retrenching the 2004 decision in Sosa versus Alvarez McChain, in which the extraterritoriality of the issue was briefed, but the Supreme Court didn't say anything about it. And I don't think we'll actually need to wait for a new Supreme Court justice. I think that lower courts are going to now have to figure out what if any, remaining claims can go forward under the APS. And so we'll have to watch them and see.
Well, we'll have to let that be our final word for now. Let me thank, on behalf of the Federalist Society, Professors Shimon Kaitner and Professor Julian Koo for joining us today. We certainly appreciate your remarks today, especially right on the heels of the recently released opinion. It's always entertaining, I think, informative for our members to have such immediate feedback on issues as they emerge. To our audience in particular, I invite you to join us for a Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m., tomorrow at 1 p.m., rather, when we'll be discussing corporate public disclosure of political activity. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.